Dr. Greg Casey joins me this week to discuss lager yeast and the evolution of brewing yeast. This is Beersmith Podcast number 278.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 278, and it's late March 2023. Dr. Greg Casey joins me this week to discuss lager yeast and the evolution of yeast. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And I recently updated the payment system for Beersmith to give you more options to purchase or renew your Beersmith desktop and web-based software. You can now purchase 2 and 3 year licenses at a discount, and you can use Venmo and Square for non-subscription payments. I urge you to consider upgrading to Beersmith 3 to address security concerns if you're still using Beersmith 2. You can find out more at beersmith.com/blog. Again, that's beersmith.com/blog. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Dr. Greg Casey. Greg has an extensive history in brewing, including Anheuser-Busch, Red Star Yeast, Stroh Brewing, Coors, Molson & Miller. He holds a PhD in applied microbiology and was president of the American Society of Brewing Chemists from 2005 to 2006. Greg, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
Thanks, Brett. Great to be back. Really happy to be talking about the love of my professional life, which was the study of lager yeast.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I didn't know you had an extensive background in yeast. Last time we had you on about a year ago, you were here to talk about your books on American lagers, American adjunct lager, if I recall.
Yep.
And I think you had two of those books nearing production on the history, right?
Yeah, pretty excited. In partnership with the Master Brewers Association and John Palmer as editor, who's done an amazing job. Mentoring me in this world of writing, because I was a applied scientist specialized in yeast. And we got first two volumes, it will be a 5-volume series in production this year to be released. And the first one's about the many myths associated with the history, the American history of adjunct lager brewing in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's the first one, examining those. The second one is about what really took place in the 1940s, when it's often quoted as when adjunct lagers started in the United States, but it's a pretty inspiring story of what the industry did during the war, and particularly after the war, during the years of global famine relief, when that was the most difficult period in the history of the industry to get the traditional ingredients of adjuncts of corn and rice. Hmm. They were the hardest to get throughout the war, and especially hard after, because grains fed people, and to avoid global famine relief, it was essential, or, you know, to give it, to provide it before the Marshall Plan. People need to be able to eat and have energy to be able to implement that. So it's an interesting history that's completely different than the paradigms.
Well, that's awesome. Do you have any idea when both books might be available?
They're in production. I am waiting to hear from my copy editor with the first draft. They're working on it now. They're a Connecticut-based firm. I don't have a firm date, but I suppose I'm hoping it's going to be no later than this fall. And they're going to come out at the same time, both volumes.
Oh, nice. And where can you find them while we're on the topic?
Well, I know it'll be at least through Scientific Societies, which is the organization that handles publications for the Master Brewers Association and the American Society of Brewing Chemists, in addition to, and we're pretty small potatoes for scientific societies, but they have a publishing arm. So that'll all become available once we get closer to actually having a firm publication date.
Nice. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's fine. I've got two passions in life. One, the professional yeast that we're going to talk about today, and the past 17 years, really, and almost on a full-time basis since retiring 10 years ago, I've been researching this century of history of American adjunct lager beer from 1840s to 1940s. So it's a nice, and we'll talk a bit, I think, at the end about where the two meet in volume three.
Nice. Well, you also have a PhD in microbiology, and you've done a lot of work on yeast over the years with all the big brewers, really. So let's start with, I know you today want to talk about lager yeast. Let's start with some of the things we've learned about lager versus ale yeast and how they're different. I know there's been a lot of genetic work done in the recent years.
Yeah, you know, and for this, I think I'll answer it at a high level. I mean, I think for most listeners, there's an innate understanding that there's two buckets. You'll hear that, you know, I frequently refer to the tale of two yeasts, but there's multiples of that. One level is ale versus lager. Ale's been around forever, and it's always been associated with fermentation at ambient temperatures. And the yeast rises to the top, as I remember watching in a Saskatoon brewery during a summer job in 1979. But eventually that does sink, you know, to the bottom, even in open ale fermenters. But lager yeast ferments cold. And it's a bottom settling yeast. So, you know, at a high level, those are the two main buckets for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, haven't we learned a lot about sort of the history of both as well?
Yeah, you know, particularly with ale, you know, they've been around, they've evolved in independent locations around the world. I mean, everybody. There's studies that keep pushing it further and further back in time in terms of when, you know, the first brewing or the first brewery was done, whether it's in Egypt or China or Mesopotamia or wherever, you know, because the yeast that does that, the ale yeast, and it's not just one, it sources relate to where they brewed it in these different continents. So there is no stereotypical ale yeast. They're quite diverse.
Yeah, I think Chris White had a chart that showed that some of them had the same history or genetic background as bread yeast, and some of them had more of a wine yeast derivative, if you will.
Yeah, I did a lot of, there's something, and I'll talk about it several times, sure. So maybe just a brief, this scientifically, the chromosome profiles, you know, karyotypes, you know, like when you go to a grocery store and you scan an item in the scanner, those bars, if you think of those as yeast chromosomes, that was something that became a tool for researchers in the 1980s to be able to get these profiles using these UPC codes. And I guess if I could summarize ale yeast, it's now for something completely different. There is no stereotypical, like I mentioned. Their karyotypes are all over the board, whether from England or Northern Germany or Canada or wherever. There is no preserved, if you will, core UPC code
interesting.
For the fingerprints, but lager yeast, oh yeah, they came from one spot of the world.
And, really?
They're much more concerned.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit. You spent your career working primarily with American lager yeast. What did you learn working at some of the largest breweries in the country?
Yeah, you know, and I'll get a little prop here.
Okay.
Anheuser-Busch, it was a chance meeting with the 1985 August Busch and his entourage came over to Denmark, and I was doing a 2-year postdoc at the time there on yeast. And they asked if there was an American working there that was studying yeast, and they said, no, we have a Canadian, and his English is excellent. Would you like to talk with him? And we did. So long story short, that's how I ended up having a professional career subsequent to that in the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I could summarize, you know, the time with Anheuser-Busch and Stroh and Coors and Miller Coors, Molson Coors, the American Light Lager, which was a beer my father would never drink, and he used all the yellow fluid analogies often associated with it every time I met him. But in terms of a delivery vehicle, if you will, it's not, obviously not a hop delivery vehicle, it's not a malt delivery vehicle. The American Light Lager is the personification of a yeast delivery vehicle in terms of the flavor and the sensory profile that consumers react to. And I think fundamentally, one of the biggest learnings over these past 30, 35 years was just how yeast-driven the, you know, secondary byproducts of yeast metabolism, the esters, the higher alcohols, acetaldehyde, things of that nature, sulfur compounds, how they drive consumer preference and how you can throughout the supply chain go in, and after you validate it with the consumers preferring, to get process control and how challenging it is. Because anybody, you know, I know within the craft world now, more interest in lagers, but the American light lager, man, that's a whole other creature. And it was professionally fascinating and rewarding to have the opportunity to work with the brewing families on their, often the yeast they'd had for quite a few generations.
Well, you started with yeast back in 1979. What was state of the art back then regarding lager yeast for the large breweries?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, Brad. I'll defer, you know, to that. The 2 years experience going in the postdoc at Carlsberg. So what was, what were the paradigms of lager yeast? We knew already that even before this karyotyping, because that technology didn't quite exist yet. We knew that they were polyploid, meaning they had multiple sets of chromosomes. You and I are both diploids. We got a copy from our mom and a copy from our dad, right? Mm-hmm. Lager yeast, we knew were polyploid. We didn't see the chromosomes in terms of physically, like we did eventually with karyotyping. But we knew from the quantification of the amount of nucleic acid in a certain cell mass that they had more than two. And we knew that they were stable as hell in the traditional sense. You couldn't induce mutations into them because you've got three, four, five copies of a gene, you know, with a haploid, you can irradiate it and boom, you can get easy mutants for leucine pathways or ice, whatever. But lager yeast, we knew that wasn't true. So we knew they were stable, we thought, and we'll talk about this maybe in a bit when we get in, when I get expand on the origins of Bavaria, but that was sort of our, you know, and we knew that they were the new kids on the block, right? And they had an identity crisis too. I remember I'd read it was Saccharomyces juvarum, it was Saccharomyces carlsbergensis, it was this, that, the other thing. I was like, would the real lager yeast taxonomy really come clear? It was very confusing at that time.
And I mean, did the large breweries change over the years as far as the yeast they use and how did they evolve it?
You know, that's a great question because I was surprised, frankly. You know, in terms of academics, you typically would have a pure culture yeast that you had, you know, frozen under glycerol, lyophilized, and you would go back to that. But what I discovered in terms of the American breweries, many American breweries, without being specific, many of them after Prohibition ended in 1933, got either revived the cultures they had in 1919, which they'd been using for low alcohol beer, non-alcoholic beer brands at the time, and started production with them. But many breweries just kept using it and using it. And using it, you know, and taking yeast from, they never went back to an original isolate from 1933 or 53 or 73 or 9. You know, it was kind of fascinating that these corporations, the yeast was, it lived with them. So I talk about nurture nature, you know, the relationship between the brewing families and the yeast, they were, you know, symbiotic in the sense of they didn't get rid of them. They allowed them to grow. And that's where I sort of came in the late 1980s in terms of, well, if they're growing, are they staying the same? And, we can talk about that, I guess, a little later too.
How does that compare to what we know now though about lager yeast? So 44 years later, obviously quite a few things have changed since 1979. What's the state of the art now?
Yeah, it's a great time to be alive if you like this sort of thing. And I do. In terms of the yeast, we knew when I was at Carlsberg, we did something, you know, we knew even before this genetic molecular biology era, linkage maps. We deduced that chromosomes existed based on linkage maps of genes along a particular chromosome. We knew they had a haploid, they had at least 16 of them in one set. We deduced it through tetrad analyses where you little blow piece of glass and you can transfer a lager chromosome into a haploid strain and study it. It was really wild. I mean, it was really cool. So we knew even then that lager yeast, at least at Carlsberg, and that's where it all started, right, in terms of pure culture, that there were at least two genomes, that there was a Saccharomyces cerevisiae which is an alcohol tolerant yeast, as we know, ubiquitous. But we also knew that there was a other strain. And, you know, even at Carlsberg, they were understanding at that time, this is going on near 4 years ago now, I guess, that there was another genome set, Eubiennes, and others that were being considered at the time. Fast forward now to today, we know very clearly, and this is where it gets really cool from history as well as the creature itself. We know that there's two core genomes. There's an alcohol-tolerant yeast in lager yeast, and there's a cold-tolerant yeast. And the hybrid's called Saccharomyces pastorianus. The individuals are Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is the tolerant, and the Eubiennes is the cold tolerant. Hmm. And it was a perfect marriage in terms of, well, how did lager yeast evolve? And in terms of the Holy Grail, I guess, seeing as this is, you know, yeast related, is where the heck did the Eubiennes parent come from? Cerevisiae, we know. Not hard to imagine. It was, you know, in fermentations in Central Europe forever. But Eubiennes, there was a big splash in, you might recall, 2011 down in Patagonia, where I read with amusement, but just my opinion that it, you know, that the yeast originated in the 15, that the cold tolerant parent came over and it was isolated in an alpine environment from wood, beech trees. And that it came in, you know, Spanish galleons to Spain and made its way, did its thing. You know, and in the lay press, of course, that's a fascinating and fun model. But since then, they've isolated this cold tolerant yeast in other alpine environments, particularly my home state of Colorado here, Tibet, China, New Zealand, and also just recently in this one, with my heritage, surname Casey, right, in a wooded area and a campus in Dublin, Ireland, which is not a terribly alpine environment. But point is, it's subsequently showing that this yeast is found, this Eubiennes, didn't just have to come from Patagonia, or Marco Polo didn't bring it from China or Tibet, and if whatever he did his thing, it's out there and it's in nature. And I sort of, we'll talk a bit later in the third volume, I sort of give a little prod to German researchers, get your butts up in the alpine environments in Central Europe and find it, because you're here, you can read everything on the internet's true, right? And now you read things, well, it's definitely this yeast didn't come from Germany and blah, blah, blah. It's part of their heritage, I believe, that as being that they deserve, because you think of wood, and in the northern environments, it's always been associated with oak. And if you looked at a brewery in Munich or Bavaria or Bohemia and the 1400s, 1500s, everything is wood, everything. It's not really hard to think how it got brought in the environment. Heck, they're even dragging pieces of glacier outside of Munich to put ice in the cellars and dragging it through the soil, just hauling it down. So, I mean, in terms of the introduction of a Eubiennes, the cold tolerant, into an environment which humans had created, we call lager breweries, that's not hard to imagine.
Hmm. And I mean, is there a historical record that shows where some of the first lagers were brewed?
We do. You know, we just know that it was definitely in Central Europe. I mean, so many things have changed there in terms of nations and borders.
Yeah.
German Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire, whatever. But I mean, it is, at least in terms of a consensus within the industry and within the scientific community, it was definitely in the Bavaria, Bohemia, Central Europe place. It's fair to say that the yeast, lager yeast today, that some of the largest lager breweries in the world trace their origins to the Spaten Brewery in Munich. Mm-hmm. So, it's definitely, there's no question about that. Lager yeast, that's Deutsch as far as I'm concerned.
Interesting. And then you mentioned that we talked about nature, but let's talk about nurture. Nurture also plays a role. Can you explain the difference, for example, between Tuborg and Carlsberg yeast and how it relates to brewing?
All right. I don't know how this is going to work out, but here's another prop. See that?
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah. Well, a lot of people listen to the podcast, so you have to describe it as well.
Yeah. But. Okay. Let me see. When I, you know, this karyotype of the UPC codes, right? That was for your benefit, Brad. Sorry about that.
Well, that's people watch it too. It's just a mixed audience. That's all.
Okay. I'll never forget the moment. There's always moments in a person's professional life, right? Where you're just astonished by something.
You know,
completely unexpected. And I'll never forget the day, a guy by the name of Mogens Pedersen at Carlsberg Labs. He was the fellow that taught me, mentored me in the procedure to generate these karyotypes, these UPC codes. So those bands I just showed you, those are all chromosomes, right?
Yeah.
And I remember being astonished. The very first gel, we had put like a dozen strains on this gel and did the electrophoresis. It was called Ophage at the time. And immediately after staining it and photographing it, I was stunned to see the band patterns were not the same between all the lengths. I mean, it sounds like a silly thing, right?
Huh.
But to the earlier point, we were talking about, oh, we thought they're stable. There's no reason to think they'd be much different, you know, in their karyotype based on chromosome profiles. But, oh, it's like, whoa. And the beauty was, you know, because that was in the same building where Emil Christian Hansen, as I found then, the first time he did pure culture yeast was not the Carlsberg brewery. He was working at the laboratory for Jakobsen, but because Jakobsen was kind of, I'm not too sure about what you're proposing here, Mr. Hansen, he went and helped the Tuborg brewery clean up their problem with sour, sulfury beer and introduced his first yeast. Pure culture was done at the Tuborg brewery, propagated at Carlsberg in the Tuborg. Again, they have those isolates. They survived the war since 1880. So, you know, it was kind of like for a yeast guy, it was in heaven being at Carlsberg because you had Hansen's, you know, Carlsberg number one yeast. You had the yeast he sent to Tuborg and they're all there revived. And I made a observation at that time. This was even before knowing I was going to be with Anheuser-Busch the Tuborg yeast and the Carlsberg yeast are similar, but distinct. Yeah, there were differences in two locations. And then, make a long story short, Brad, in the last 30, 40 years, I've looked at, every brewer has an extensive culture collection, right?
Right.
The Busch, Stroke, or everybody's got somebody else's yeast that they picked up somewhere or the other, and they just throw it in their culture collection. And I've been able to, hundreds, I've lost count. Production strains, not culture collections like ATCC or whatever. I mean, these are the real deal, things that brewers use. And I only found, of the hundreds, I only found three brewers that used a Tuborg type yeast.
Interesting.
And there were hundreds that used Carlsberg, virtually all of whom are out of business. And the reason I believe, and this is where, you know, I'm just giving my personal paradigms, but it's based on practical experience. The Tuborg yeast, let's just say the Carlsberg, the one that was most widely spread. And W34, by the way, the German yeast, that fits that Carlsberg profile. It's not an official classification. It's just something I coined for myself based on personal observations. But the Carlsberg yeast is a brewer's dream. What do I mean by that? You can run a truck over it, and it isn't going to care. You can mismanage to a certain degree yeast management processes. It's predictable. It's resistant to acid washing. It's just a truck.
Okay.
You know, it's it done. Whereas the Tuborg yeast, it's a prima donna. I mean, it truly is.
Fickle.
It's more fickle. It does not tolerate any deviations from yeast management processes in terms of time, temperatures, conditions, acid washing. It's like, death. And it's been fascinating to see that. So I could see from operations why, well, screw this. This bugger over here is hard to work with and manage. And this one is like I said, drive a truck over. Well, the difference is the Tuborg, in terms of consumer preference, there's fundamental and consistent differences. Getting back to the first conversation, on the sensory profiles of these yeast. And a Tuborg gives a beer that's a little more fruity. August Busch is referred to the drinkable term, but there's correlations between specific aspects of the karyotype with flavor profiles that the, particularly those that like American light lagers prefer, whereas the Tuborg is more sulfur. And what was it? Ray Daniels. Have you talked to Ray Daniels?
Oh, sure. I've had Ray on at least once before.
I'm old enough. I went to brewing school with him at Siebel's. No, I'm much older than Ray, I think. Anyhow, he coined the term tens, Tuborg estuary, not sulfur. You know, I gave a lecture while I was at Siebel at the time and talked about it. He said tens, Tuborg estuary, not sulfury. And the Carlsberg sulfur. And they've, every one of them, you know, the Schaefer, the Schlitz, the list goes on and on and on of American brewers. Every one of them used the Carlsberg type. And the only two that were United States are very much alive today. And I refer to that estuary character in case folks are wondering who they are.
Interesting. Can you get these at the homebrew level? Is there a way to distinguish what we're buying at the homebrew level, perhaps?
This term that I coined, the Tuborg Carlsberg, it's not an industrial, it's not a classification. All I can say, Brad, is over the years, I have taken a look at various suppliers of yeast for the craft industry, sure, for example, and Y yeast, for example. They have a yeast they call the Rocky Mountain yeast.
Okay.
And I can confirm that that is a Tuborg yeast.
Okay.
And based on the karyotype. But also Alfred Jorgensen lab, that they also, which is in Denmark, they have a Tuborg type yeast too. And I've, over the years at different breweries, have worked with both of those. Maybe after this or subsequent to this, if anybody's particularly interested in terms of getting a commercially available Tuborg type based on Greg Casey's, system, I'd be happy to share that.
Yeah, maybe I've got Chris White on in a couple of weeks from White Labs. I'll ask him too if he maybe knows which one's which.
Yeah, I haven't looked there. You know, I didn't. The Y yeast I did during my Stroh years. For
sure.
Example.
Sure.
This hypothesis was very much forming in my head at that time. And so I start to look and why yeast for whatever. This is pre-internet, I guess, right? So I ended up just getting the catalog and taking a look at everything that they had. So it was kind of like, oh, here's a fourth kind of deal.
Interesting. Well, what's the nature-nurture balance here, and how do yeast react over time to human-controlled selection? I think you mentioned some of the large brewers use the same yeast many, many, many times over.
Yeah. If you could bear with me on this one, Brad.
Sure, go ahead.
One of the, I want to say, things I wish I learned a lot earlier in my career was in terms of new product development, you know, the stages associated with new product development. You know, so there's a concept, a feasibility, kind of a little study. You develop it, you implement it, you put it out in trade, and then you review and improve, right?
Sure.
If we look at the evolution, the nature nurture, you know, between yeast and man, if we look at the evolution of two simultaneous new products, lager yeast and lager beer, I mean, they evolve concurrently. And if you look at the, you know, say a concept stage, we'll never know who somebody, you know, in Bavaria, the origins of lager. And everything was and had been for many, many centuries had been ales and fermented at ambient temperatures, often spoiled, you know, high risk. But somebody somewhere put some kegs in a cold cellar and realized, this beer looks different. It was not spoiled. It was a new kind of beer, but they really didn't. Obviously, this would have been just an observation. And that's often, I believe, how concept happens. But I'd say it's fair to say, based on research the last 15, 17 years, actually, you know, in terms of from the 14th to 16th century, as I look at the new product development, that those were the concept and feasibility stages of the evolution of the yeast and the creature. They didn't know what yeast was, right? They call this company called the Zug, the stuff. But it it was something that was repeated, a repeated observation. And in the colder months, they had a better chance of getting that beer that didn't spoil. Again, not knowing the genetics or what was going on. But humans being humans, as I mentioned, it's to me very clear where the Ubayanis came from, you know, in terms of local sources in the German and Bavarian and Austrian Alps. In 1553, Bavarian, obviously the Rheinhessenbund, that's separate from this discussion, yeah, yeah. But I call this the development phase from 1553, when it was by decree and by law, they could only brew between St. Michael's and St. George, other way around, but it was just from like September to April. They could only brew those months. And that was just basically applying, that's why I call it development, because they realized by that point in time, hey, we got a much better chance of getting this style of beer and getting this yeast to come along for the ride if we do that. And there was about three centuries, I think, that the development stage lasted. And then, you know, implementation, I think that's really the 1850s when in Germany, you know, advances in refrigeration and everything else, that they allowed brewing of lager year-round. It wasn't just a seasonal beer. It could be brewed year-round. But it was still, as you look at a progression of how what their batting average was in terms of concept, feasibility, development, you know, they were still getting a lot of bad batches. Trust me, I'm sure of that.
Yeah,
they weren't getting pure lager every single time, but their odds got progressively better. And then, you know, I think the review phase, if you will, came with Hansen. You know, when Jakobsen went down to the Spaten Brewery, Munich brought back the lager yeast culture, mixed culture with him, and then decades later, Hansen teased them apart and developed pure culture yeast. To me, and that's where, boom, you know, in terms of if you've got good hygiene, your likelihood of getting a consistent lager with a consistent yeast happens. So that's a long-winded sort of nature, you know, and have, you know, there was a profession. Yeah, they didn't know what yeast was to Pasteur and all that. But, I mean, they knew, and I'll show for your benefit, I realize not anywhere else, but,
sure.
You know, this sort of thing, you know, like a pitch, this is a yeast read. They
okay.
would take it from the bottom. I bought this through my postdoc at Carlsberg. Throw it, you know, pitch it from one batch to the next. You know, trial and error, humans observations. They realized, we got a better chance of getting lager. That I didn't know what they called it. They even, well, they knew we were storing cold, but you catch my drift. So, I mean, in terms of the evolution using new product development timelines for both the yeast and the style, it was a long journey, but it was one that without man or yeast, it would never have happened. So I think it's a perfect marriage of nurture and nature.
What about that question from the perspective of a large modern brewery? How much do they tweak things over time, perhaps with the yeast? How often do they reuse the yeast? And how do they purposely alter it?
Well, you know, the one thing brewers were good at that when I came down to the States, all the big boys, they had culture collections where they had samples of production yeast going back decades, right? And I was able to act, where are you going to get those? You're not going to get those at ATCC or culture collections, right? There's only one place on the planet for a particular brewery those exist, and that's on the grounds of a, you know, brewery that's been part of the family for generations. So I was able to look at them in many locations, not just Anheuser-Busch, Coors, but, you know, everywhere I went along the way, all these stops. Took a look at these yeasts from various years. And the one thing that became apparent was, and I published this in 1994 paper at the Master Brewer Association.
Sure.
I had permission from the Stroh Brewery to publish our findings. And it showed, you know, these UPC codes, you know, like a 1951 versus a 1959 versus 60, whatever. They didn't line up.
You know, of course not. Yeah,
they were, you know, there had been some evolution going on there. And again, that was, to me, by that point in time, I was realizing, oh yeah, these things can really adapt to changes in environment. Yeah, we would look at this in various breweries where I was at, and I don't know the history of before I was born, let alone, you know, the late 50s, early 60s, I'd ask them, well, what changed in, because sometimes they would stay stable for like 5-6 years, same, boom, 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 boom. Then all of a sudden, you know, you got a shift and it might last for a year or two. And not, you know, so it wasn't just like constantly changing. So we were with, you know, with the old timers, go back in the records in terms of yeast propagation. Was that a year, you know, or, you know, what did the records show? What changed? Because the yeast is obviously reacting to some environmental parameter or nutritional parameter. And in fascinating, it was pretty, pretty high batting average being able to correlate it to a specific change in the propagation process or the yeast harvesting or yeast management processes that that particular brewery had in place at the time.
Well, this is just a side question, but do they ever purposely change their yeast? I mean, do they actually go, you know, we're gonna try this one now, or does that not happen?
Not to my knowledge, certainly not with the American Light Lager. It is so, you know, it's so ingrained. The sensory profile is so specific to that family's yeast. Well, I keep saying family, so obviously Anheuser-Busch with ABI, but you know, when I was there, it was family owned. I mean, those are. Talk about the crown jewels, right? I mean, again, yeah. Sensory profiles. So now they, to the best of my knowledge, experimenting, at least in the realm of the American Light Lagers, once those yeast got dialed in, it was the holy grail to preserve it, protect it, make it as reproducible as possible through the review process. And we, and that's kind of, you know, where Hansen came in and nerds like me, much later, a fellow by the name of Dr. Robert Wall, he's a fellow that he went to Carlsberg 100 years ago, I think it was 1884, to study Hansen's process for pure culture. And he's the guy that brought it back to the United States. And he introduced it in Hansen wrote a book, 1896, about what was happening during that kind of fascinating time. And you know, he was saying Wall introduced it to Schlitz, to Pabst, to Anheuser-Busch. I mean, this pure culture technique wasn't developed in the United States by any means, but it was sure European, you know, novelty or innovation that found quick adherence in the United States. And I give Dr. Robert Wall, he will feature very prominently in many of these later books in the volumes. And the cool thing is, I walked through the exact same door he walked through 99 years to the day later, almost to the day, in 1983. He was there in 1884, and it's the same building, same door, wow. Everything. It's kind of a cool moment.
Yeah. How do you think the rapid gain in both genetic and microbiological knowledge might be used to create new and interesting yeast strains?
Again, I defer, just like to me, it's, if you like beer, there's never been a better time to be alive with the craft. You know, the American craft movement that is like the American light lager movement that's spread around the world in the last 100 years. Because let's face it, adjunct lager is by far the, you know, the king of beers, not to say a brand, but, you know, the dominant style of beer globally. You know, the craft revolution, which started here, and it's very parallel to me in terms of the 50 years into it. If you look, like, I think this second revolution is like half a century in the craft. If you look at where the adjunct lager revolution was in the States from the 1870s, 19, whatever, you know, it's following a similar course where it's becoming a global. I mean, this, you know, in terms of the influence of the craft and the American brewing industry on a global basis is, to me, is quite inspiring. It's not just, I think the United States should have a little bit of a green jacket in a master's clubhouse with next to England and Belgium and Germany. But hey, we could argue that point over a lot of beers in Berlin or wherever. But it's a great time to be alive. But in terms of long-winded explanation to say, in terms of yeast, I mean, if you look at you know, the lager world in particular, and you know, if you look at somebody to borrow, you know, something we're talking about a lot these days in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion. To me, lager yeast, they have had yeast privilege that Hansen developed, which has been fine from the perspective of producing a consistent lager yeast. But in terms of diversity, the genetic pool that's out there, I mean, it's a crime almost, yeah. You know, in terms of not taking full advantage of what nature has to offer to, you know, to mimic a nature nurture kind of scenario for new flavors, for non-alcoholic beers. I see people, VTT and other places, creating their own species hybrids between different yeasts, seeing how they produce in lager. Non-alcoholic beers, I mean, they're exploding. There's all kinds of potential for different strains of yeast.
I had a group on the other day that were talking about low alcohol yeast that produce very, very small amounts of alcohol. Yeah. And he actually sent me some of the beers. They were actually quite good. I was shocked, actually.
Yeah, and again, those are non-GMO, right? Most of my professional career, the emphasis was, we're going to splice this gene and put this one here. We're going to make an hemolytic, and it's going to boom, boom, boom. Well, the public wanted nothing to do, but that never did really transpire for good reason. Didn't need to. You could keep it natural, and I think that's what's exciting, for me, former professionally, to see and come across this interest in, you know, including far more diversity, equity, given those an opportunity, and given lager yeast, which had privilege to be the global yeast for the last 140 years, whatever, a run for their money, and to make it a more diverse industry in terms of flavor profiles and possibilities that you can find. So it's a pretty cool time.
Yeah, it was very interesting to taste of, you know, like what, 0.5% or less beer that tasted very much like a regular beer. It was really pretty cool.
Well, and a lot of these products, I mean, when I was at Stroh, we had something, and it was really wild. We had something called the Centrotherm, which was a centrifugal removal of alcohol post-fermentation.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
We sent to Saudi Arabia double Centrotherm. So Schlitz NA, Schlitz non-alcoholic, had been the Centrotherm twice. It was less than 0.05, and sent to Saudi Arabia. Well, that was certainly as strange in terms of my days in quality assurance and research, as was the very last beer at Stroh that my team was involved with, was a Schlitz malt liquor Hapashu, which is the Japanese style, right?
Oh.
25% malt.
Interesting.
I was like, oh my God, this is getting weird.
Yeah.
And tried to control the flavor profile in a Schlitz malt liquor Hapashu. Made in Texas.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Made in Texas,
yeah. Did you integrate any of your professional experiences with the yeast into your 5-volume series?
Yeah, because the emphasis in the series, when I started this series, was strictly an interest. I've always been interested in history. Totally. I wanted to be a history teacher when I was finishing high school, but then in Ontario, the jobs were pretty unavailable. So I went into applied science, but, so I've always been interested in history. And as I got towards the end of my career, I made a conscious decision. What kind of passion am I going to have in retirement? I'm not going to keep doing the yeast thing as much as I loved it. I think it's important to, find a new love, if you will, other than a marriage. I'm still my wife's first husband after 43 years, but I want to do something different. That's where history came in. And being a naturalized citizen, I already had some of my own paradigms about the history of the beer. I learned to love and respect.
Sure.
and work with some fabulous teams on helping with process control to deliver. So I said, well, let's start delving into this. And and yeast obviously is a fundamental aspect of lager, and in adjunct lager, it's even more important. So I do have in this, it's called Volume 3. The series is the Inspiring History and Legacies of American Lager Beer. When I say lager beer, I'm referring to adjunct lager beer from the the first brews were. A guy, Dave Haker, who was from Austria-Hungary, he was born in the German part. But anyhow, he had a patent on the use of Indian corn. No disrespect, but that's what they called it then. And he had a patent on it. He came in the height of the Civil War and spent the entire year of 1863, both the North and the South, in doing trial brews in American breweries. And he wrote a book about it. And it's really cool to read, being run out of town in Indianapolis when the German community got windy. Use corn in their brewery. He was literally run out of town.
Oh no!
But yeah, But the yeast is obviously so ingrained in this, and that's where, you know, I think it's fair to say, getting back to that analogy, that the lager yeast, it went through that German journey, right? And you can't tell the American story without telling the German story.
Sure.
And it's true for the yeast, just as it's true the same when you look at adjunct lager beer. It's the same deal, that adjunct lager concept, feasibility, development, implementation wasn't in the United States when that first happened. That was clearly, and the history is, there's no doubt about this based on primary period references. All that was done in Germany, and they, it was brought over here, if you will, the perfection, and I say perfection, not to be sarcastic, but I believe that in terms of the perfection of the American adjunct lager, and in particular, the first chill-proof lager beer for decades, from the 1880s, 90s, noughts, and tens, only American lager was chill-proof. Mind you, we're the only ones that wanted it that way. We drank it out of a glass of ice cold, but it was a marriage of a society and people to their beer and their yeast, if you will. So, yeah, I talk about it, how it got here. You know, in Milwaukee, it came in a barrel of sawdust, and it was, put into a kettle that had boiled wort, and, eventually they got enough of the Zug stuff to be able to brew with it. But they, there's stories of it being in loaves and in bread. The Hefner's was a profession where compressed yeast would be taken from, being in, the origins of Germany, compress it, sell it for other brewers to use. It came to our shores by a lot of different variety or mechanism or processes, but it was this Dr. Robert Wall who saw the potential, because it was, like everything else, it was kind of controversial at the time. There were many forces that said, no, you can't have a real beer, a real lager, just one strain. You got to have, so there was a lot of resistance, but Wall was convinced. He convinced Anheuser Busch, Pabst Blitz, and I think that's a pretty good core that he started with in terms of how they've fared.
Well, I wanted to get your closing thoughts. Unfortunately, we're running low on time now, Greg, but what are your closing thoughts after 40-some-odd years working with yeast?
It would really have to get back to that earlier point. We're just scratching the surface. Hansa did a wonderful thing in terms of bringing process control and consistency in delivering, one style of beer, which was, really manifested in the American Light Lager. But there's so much out there. As I'm repeating myself a bit, but I guess I would just encourage, what I'm delighted to see, so many university programs in the United States with brewing majors. We lost that with Prohibition. We had a lot of scientific stations and brewing schools, particularly in Chicago, New York, Milwaukee. Those all disappeared, when Prohibition came along. And they're now just catching up in terms of education in various campuses, universities across the country. So my final thought would be, seek and you shall find some things you don't expect. And I wish I was 20-something again and could get out there. But anyhow, that's kind of how I'd like to wrap this up.
Well, Greg, I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thank you. It was great. I've talked about my two loves in my life with you, Brad. So I'm awesome. Out of loves in terms of interests outside of family life. But I've been blessed to really have a fun career in the first one. And as I said, I'm looking forward to these five volumes coming out between now and 2026. Yeah. And it's going to be challenging a lot of paradigms, both American and German, relative to the history of adjunct lager beer.
Awesome. Well, today my guest was Dr. Greg Casey. Greg is working on a five-volume set on the history of adjunct lagers and has over 40 years of experience in yeast and large-scale brewing. Thanks again, Greg.
Thanks, Brad.
A big thank you to Dr. Greg Casey for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And I recently updated the payment system for Beersmith to give you more options to purchase or renew your Beersmith desktop and web-based software. You can now purchase 2- and 3-year licenses at a discount, and you can use Venmo and Square for non-subscription payments. I urge you to consider Up Beersmith 3 today. You can find out more at beersmith.com. Again, that's beersmith.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.